Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we're devoting our entire show to bring you a very special debate between candidates in the hotly contested 50th Congressional District race to fill the seat vacated by Duncan Hunter, who resigned after pleading guilty to a federal corruption charge. The candidates are Amar Campanajar and Daryl Issa. East County Magazine is a media sponsor of this debate, moderated by the League of Women Voters and hosted by Community Action Service and Advocacy, or CASA, along with the East Region Collaborative Network, the East County Homeless Task Force, and the 9th District PTA.
Thank you, everyone, for attending tonight, and thank you to the Community Action Service and Advocacy for hosting. My name is Donna Bartlett-May, and I'm going to be your moderator tonight from the League of Women Voters. Even though we do miss seeing you all in person, there are advantages to these virtual meetings. Many people who otherwise might not be able to tune in can now do so from their homes. It's good for the candidates to get their information out there in this way so people could fill out their ballots being informed voters. We do have some housekeeping rules. Audience members will be off mic and off camera, so you don't have to worry about stifling any of your household noise. If you have any questions, please click into the chat at the bottom. Or if you don't see the chat, just click more. A little about the League. We are proud to be nonpartisan, neither supporting nor opposing candidates or political parties. We always work on vital issues of concern to members and the public. The League moderates these candidate forums all over the country in a fair and balanced way. We ask candidates to defer from making personal attacks, but rather keep to the issues and the positions, because our goal is for voters to be able to determine more about the candidates than they get from campaign ads and social media. The forum is copyrighted by the League of Women Voters, and for the private use of our audience and any other video without consent is prohibited. We asked attendees to submit questions online before the forum. Those in attendance may also submit questions using the link provided in the chat box. Please remember to use civility and respect when wording your questions and word them so both candidates can answer. Question screeners organize the questions to avoid duplication and ensure topics of greatest interest are being asked within the time available. Also, screeners will ensure the questions asked are appropriate for the branch of government involved in this forum. Those assisting tonight from the League are experienced screener, Jane Andrews. The screener from CASA is Mary McKenzie, and our timekeeper is Scarlett Lopez. We will adjourn by 8 o'clock. With that said, I want to thank you all for joining us tonight and becoming an informed voter. So we will begin. This is the forum for the United States House of Representatives 50th Congressional District. Candidates will have 2 minutes for opening statements, 2 minutes for closing statements, and 1 minute to answer the questions. We will alternate who answers questions first. Mr. Issa is going to go first for his opening statements. We determined that beforehand. And so we will begin now with the opening statements. Mr. Issa, you'll have to take yourself off mute, please.
Okay, it took both of us to get it done, I'm afraid. In 2000, when I made the decision to run for the seat that my predecessor was leaving after an 18-year career, I did so knowing that that going to Congress is a serious action and one that you have to really get good at what you're doing. So I sold my business, gave up any investments in any conflicting stocks or bonds, and dedicated myself to being a congressman. And then 9/11 came, and what could have been a few years turned into more years of dealing with the longest war in American history, supporting our troops, and dealing with the many challenges America has faced. 2 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, President Trump was elected, and I was asked to serve in his administration. reluctantly, I gave up my seat in Congress and stood in line waiting to be confirmed by the Senate. As happened to many, many people in that line, hundreds of us were filibustered and never got confirmed. And then Duncan Hunter announced that he would be leaving. It was already obvious. And that created a situation in which I felt that it was the right time to go back and do something that I love doing, that I believe I did well, and that I'm very dedicated to. And fortunately, the 50th Congressional District is about one third of a district that I represented for 12 years, and which I'm very proud to say in the primary went for me in a large way. So I know politics is about a lot of things, but quite frankly, I've enjoyed public service. I like what I do, and I like the opportunity to help people, and that's why I'm coming back to Congress.
Perfect, 2 minutes on the dot. Mr. Campanajar?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having us. My name is Amar Campanajar, running for Congress now almost for 4 years now for this 2-year term in the 50th Congressional District. I was honored to just 2 years ago represent nearly half the district with the election that went 48.3% my way, literally 1.7% more. The wind could have blown and we'd have a congressman today instead of being absent one. And the reason I'm running for Congress here is simple. I'm from this community. My mom raised me in a certain way that made me feel like I wanted to devote my life to service. My dad left when I was relatively young. So my mom raised me on her own through being broke and brokenhearted, worked multiple jobs, always took full responsibility, but was always shortchanged on opportunity. And I realized later on in life that was because we're in the grips of a broken system that rewards wealth more than work. And we even see that today happening as we're battling COVID-19. I had to work as a janitor at the age of 15 at my local church to help my mom make ends meet. Then I got to go work at the White House, the U.S. Department of Labor, the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And after serving in D.C. a couple of years, I decided to come back and give back to the community that made me the man I am today. There are so many people who have made sacrifices for their dreams to make my dreams possible in this community, including my mom. And I wanted to come back and return the favor and make sure people could live, work, and retire with dignity. Make sure that all those who are wanting to take responsibility are given opportunity to live out the American dream that's been shut out for so many people. And if I'm honored to serve as your representative, I promise to make you proud. If you don't vote for me and you vote for Daryl Issa, I also hope to make you proud if I'm elected. And even if you don't vote for me this election, if I'm in Congress, I'll be voting for you, for your family's health care, make sure you have a decent living, and again, that you could work, live, and retire with dignity. In the end, we're all Americans, and that seems to be lost these days among some of our leaders, but I hope to bring back that virtue that we're all American in the end. I hope to have your support.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Issa, we'll start the first question with you. What policy steps would you endorse to protect water in the western states?
I think that's a very good question, and it's one that I've worked on that is not partisan. It's an issue where we work pretty much together on trying to make sure there is good availability. Some of the initiatives that have become partisan obviously include the north of California denying the free flow to the south that was historically promised, and that has created an additional challenge. Some of those challenges can be met, as we have with the help of federal funding, with desalinization efforts, but some of them can be a little bit more uniquely met. For example, the Colorado River could be used for an additional, what they call one or two turns of water through minor desalinization. And that's an effort that is supported by Juan Vargas, myself, and others that would provide a substantial amount of water where the water already exists.
Thank you. Mr. Campanajar?
Yeah, I think those are all good proposals. I think there's a lot of bipartisan solutions, especially in San Diego. We have, you know, we could do blue energy and green energy here to sustain our natural heritage and make sure that we have clean drinking water available. As I've talked to people across the district, I've talked to farmers who've said that their crops are withering on the vine because the hots are getting hotter, and the reality of these extreme weather patterns are something that they're feeling first, right? You don't need to listen to the scientists to learn about climate change. Farmers felt it beneath their feet before anybody else did. And I think part of the solution is also dealing with why do we have the scarcity of resources? And that's because of, as the military has said, the biggest threat we face in this country is climate change. change. And part of that cascading effect is wildfires and also the lack of drinkable water. So I think we have to confront the facts and also work on a bipartisan fashion to make sure we have a flow of drinking water with desalinization, with Colorado, and all the things that we just talked about.
Okay. Mr. Kapanajar, we'll start the next question with you. What is your position on Proposition 16, the reinstatement of affirmative action in California?
Yeah, I think that that's obviously a state issue, but I think it's important that we learn from history and understand that there are certain groups in this country who from birth, they start at a different mark in life because of the fact that they come from families that weren't able to build wealth. Thinking about the African-American community that helped build this country for generations for free, never got the 40 acres and a mule, were segregated, were criminalized by laws that changed to make them, again, work for free as people who were imprisoned. And then people who fought in our wars, never got the GI Bill, never were able to get affordable loans. So I think that there are some people who have had certain benefits in life from birth, and then there are others who've just been set behind through no fault of their own. And the idea of affirmative action is to allow those communities who've been disadvantaged through no fault of their own because of institutional racism an opportunity to get kind of level footed.
Thank you. Mr. Eisen?
I was not just a supporter of Prop 209, I was co-chair of it, along with Ward Connolly and a number of others. I'll read the words because it is important. The state shall not discriminate against or grant a preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. That is really a mirror of exactly what our federal constitution says and believes, and it's now in our state constitution. And I object to it being removed. You can support affirmative action by looking for legitimate outreach on other issues. People who have just come to the United States and would have been at a disadvantage in their education. People who are economically at a different level. There's nothing in our Constitution that prohibits outreach. But the fact is, Prop 209 has worked. The minority graduation rate has risen under this, and I support the continuation of our Constitution.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa, you'll start this one. What is your stance on federal law enforcement reform?
Well, I served in the House with Tim Scott, traveled with him, and I trust him to be a good steward of the legislation he's proposed in the Senate that I believe makes a lot of sense. Obviously, the federal government has a slight role on the state basis and a big role on the federal basis. So when we look at mandatory body cams, so that never again will something happen out of sight, if at all possible, that's important. But I think we have to also remember that the men and women of law enforcement, the vast majority of the time, are the ones being victimized by somebody who is aggressive, who has a gun, and so on. And so I think we have to have a fair balance, which is support the men and women in uniform and hold them accountable. One of the things that Senator Scott is pushing for is to enhance the penalty for anyone who fraudulently files a police report. We're talking about the police and others. So I trust Tim Scott. I look forward to working with him.
Thank you. Mr. Kapanajar?
Yeah, I think we're dealing with a reckoning right now as a country, and there are definitely the majority of police officers are good people. But I think we have to have some institutional changes to make sure that our police departments reflect the best of them. And so I gave a 10-point plan that doesn't include defunding the police, because I don't think that's a solution. I think that the problem we have in America, in some places over-policing, but in other communities we have under-policing. And even MLK was talking about that many, many generations ago. So what I would suggest is listening to our police officers. I've talked to police officers who say, I didn't get into the business of being a police officer to have to, they say, you know, take care of homeless people or deal with mental health issues. Let's let the professionals do that. Let me focus on my job. That's not part of my job. But the things that we should do is have national standards for training, for disengagement, and de-escalation. Make sure that we update the Defense Reauthorization Act to make sure that we're allowing them to purchase the police officers to purchase goggles and helmets and boots, but not necessarily these other weapons of war that we see in our streets today. So there's a list of reforms that are moderate that make sense that we could do.
Thank you very much. The next question, we'll start with you, Mr. Campanajar. What actions or policies will you promote in Congress to increase public safety in your community?
Absolutely. So we talked about some of these reforms to redesign the police department and bring it more in alignment with its value of serving and protecting and serving the public. But the other aspects too, that one thing I think we can do, especially with at-risk youth who end up in crime if they're not shown the straight and narrow path, is investing in childcare and early pre-K. Studies show that if you invest in our youth young, it's the best return on investment as a government, because they will be more likely to return that investment in the form of being responsible tax-paying Americans who either are working full-time or have a business of their own. So really starting with our youth, making sure that we have a pipeline from cradle to career of a good middle-class life, and make sure that kids aren't out of desperation getting involved in the wrong kinds of things. So that investment in our youth, at-risk youth, like I did at the Department of Labor, giving them summer jobs, coupled with redesigning law enforcement on some issues, I think is a pathway to public safety.
Thank you. Mr. Issa, you'll need to unmute. Kim, do you need to help?
Yeah, there we go. I kept saying the host has to unmute. When it comes to public safety, I'm proud to have the endorsement of the San Diego and Riverside Deputy Sheriff's Associations. I'm proud to have the support of the National Organization for the Border Patrol, for ICE, and broadly law enforcement support. Some of that is from the years of working on getting funding for anti-gang activities and for the courts. And part of it, I think, is simply understanding that the federal government can, in fact, help, and we do help with all kinds of items, and not just goggles. Many of the defensive weapons that allow standoff and police surveillance come from the federal government, and I'm proud that I've been part of making sure that came. At the end of the day, there are other things that need to be done in the community, but when it comes to making our streets safe by making sure that a well-trained and coordinated with the federal government law enforcement, that's what we need to do in Congress. That's what I've done.
Thank you. Another question, how specifically, and we'll start with you, Mr. Issa, would you protect Second Amendment rights?
I remember some years ago, after holding Eric Holder, the Attorney General, in contempt for his organization's misconduct in trying to blame the gun dealers for what in fact was a failed botched program by his administration that put 2,000 weapons in the hands of the worst of the worst in Mexico, leading to the death of Brian Terry. So sometimes to protect the Second Amendment, you have to make sure that you protect against attacks on it. And I'm proud to be endorsed and supported by the NRA. I've spoken before their national convention. I feel very strongly that the decision the U.S. Supreme Court made, that in fact it is an individual right and militia is not a statement for some state right, has been strong, and I'll continue to support it. And I think that is one of the greater contrasts in this race.
Thank you. Mr. Campanajar?
Yeah, I'm a personal gun owner. I have a Smith & Wesson and a Mossberg 500 with a shotgun. And I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe that the wisdom out of this problem of gun violence is inherent in the Second Amendment. Our founders left us some incredible wisdom. There it said, well-regulated militia. So my brother's about to join the Navy, and before he's issued his weapon, he has to go through a background check, learn about safe storage, go through a psych evaluation, and go through some training. And I think if we had some of those elements in civilian life, people would be better served and better trained. And a lot of gun owners who respect guns, they support these measures. A big percentage of NRA members support background checks. These are things that we can do without infringing on people's Second Amendment rights. And it's really important to understand, for people who don't understand gun culture, the term assault weapon is something that was invented in Washington. That's not vernacular among gun owners. So we should be focusing more on the capacity of guns, not the way they look, and also focus on the mental health aspect, which I think is a really, really key part of addressing gun violence and protecting people's Second Amendment rights.
Thank you. Let's go to some education questions. Mr. Campanajar, you'll answer this one first. Do you support student loan forgiveness?
Absolutely. And I want to, you know, we realize that a lot of teachers or other types of public servants who get the public service loan forgiveness program after 10 years of paying down their loans, get their loans forgiven. 10 years is a very long time. And I think we should expand what public service means these days because it's taking on a different shape. So I'd love to be able to see us have those kinds of reforms. And on the front end, there's things we could do to make college more affordable for every student. One thing we could do is invest more in vocational training, get more people to get a middle-class job that way. That frees up tuition for those who have a semblance of a plan of graduating and reduce the front-end cost. And that way they have less debt that they're saddled with. But I've talked to countless families, including a woman who told me, I saved money for my daughter to go to college, and now both of us are in debt. Why does the education of one person cost the debt of two generations? And that's getting right at the heart of the problem. And I think what we can do is expand the public service loan forgiveness program on the front end, create a pipeline to vocational training so we have more money for those who have a plan to graduate.
Thank you. Mr. Issa?
No, I don't support loan forgiveness in the broadest sense. What I do support is something that my opponent talked positively about. We need to drive down the cost of healthcare. And in my case, I want to drive down the cost of healthcare, real competition. The fact is that a philosophy degree or an English degree in constant dollars has been going up. There's no logical reason that they shouldn't have been going down, that it shouldn't be automated, that in fact, unless you choose to go to an Ivy League school, you shouldn't be potentially burdened with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. But if you've taken on that debt, the only thing I do support, and I support it very strongly, is that the repayment of that debt should and could be tax-free if, in fact, an employer wants to make that a portion of somebody's salary so that it wouldn't be paying it twice to get it paid back. And I support that strongly. But I will say this. I saw the hearings in Washington when Maxine Waters asked all the banks about the debt problem. And the fact was she was out of touch because the debt problem was created when government took it on and took it away from the banks.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Issa, we'll start the next question with you. Should the federal government fully fund special education?
Boy, I've been dealing with that since the day I went to Congress now 20 years ago. The fact is that all the way back in the Jimmy Carter era, we promised to fully fund, if you will, IDEA. The problem is that the definition is a moving target and the price has gone up, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars per student. So one of those commitments, if you were to look at the size of the problem at the time the promise was made, it has been kept. If you look at the growth in the size of the problem, it hasn't. And I think that's one of the challenges of special education is that we have to get smarter in it. We have to recognize that some of what's being called special education is in fact very expensive care for people who may never be able to work or whose work skills will never be brought to a level of competition. So I think some reform is needed and the federal government has increased what it's given over the years.
Thank you. Mr. Campanajar?
Yeah, I find that troubling, that last statement, but I won't respond to my opponent. I think everybody has inherent worth and everybody has value and they can participate in our economy. And just because you have special needs doesn't mean that you should be locked out of opportunity. But I do agree with the IDEA Act. We promised to allocate funding for that to provide, to cover 40% of the costs for students with needs. We've never lived up to that promise. We should at least do that and understand that during right now in COVID, the children who are affected the most by this are those kids with special needs, children with autism who cannot study virtually and do this kind of interfacing. They need to be in school. So we need to be moving heaven and earth to make it sooner than later safe for children to return to school. Not do it prematurely, but understand that nothing we do virtually is going to make the accommodations necessary for children with special needs. So during this really trying time, we need to make sure we're doing everything we can to resume life as normal for these children. And one of those ways is making sure we have school in person that's safe.
Thank you. Before the next question, Mr. Campanajar, we had a comment that some people are having trouble hearing you. So if you could speak up a little bit, that would be great.
The first time I was told I'm soft-spoken. So
Okay, we're going to go to some economic questions. Mr. Campanajar, you're first with this one. What is your position on small business assistance during the pandemic and in the future?
Yeah, so I worked at the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and we represented 4 million Hispanic businesses that collectively contributed $1 trillion a year to the economy. Two-thirds of all new jobs are created by small businesses. Half of people in this country are employed by small businesses. They are the engine of ingenuity and job creation in this country. And what I worked on there, was, and I will do it in Congress, is to make sure these small businesses, veteran-owned, minority-owned, women-owned, have access to credit, capital, and contracts from the government and with supply chains with major corporations. And right now during COVID, they need it the most. We need to make sure that small businesses are getting the PPP loans that are now running out, and we need to reinstitute them and make sure that these big conglomerates, these big multinational companies are not skipping to the front of the line because they're well off and well connected and taking food out of people's mouths, basically, because these small businesses can't thrive if these bigger corporations and more wealthy individuals are using their connections to skip the front of the line and get a PPP loan that they shouldn't be applying for in the first place during this current time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa?
Well, having been a small businessman, starting a company from nothing and building it up to hundreds of jobs, I'm acutely aware of what it takes. And I'm acutely aware, quite frankly, that in the beginning of this pandemic, my former colleagues in the House and Senate came together. Matter of fact, it was almost unanimous, 419-6. And they voted for the CARES Act. They sent more than $1 trillion downstream in the best way they could. Now, I know they made mistakes. There were things that if you had to do it over again, you wouldn't do it exactly the same way. But it was a bipartisan attempt to do the right thing. Where I'm concerned is that broke down. And when another $1 trillion was offered, much of it for small businesses, very specifically to help small businesses, the answer was, no, we need $3 trillion and we need lots of aid to individuals, including more money to stay home than to go back to work in some cases. I need to make sure that we change that back to promoting small business, being able to stay alive and help people get back to work.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa, we'll start the next question with you. Should the minimum wage be the same throughout the United States? What level do you support?
Well, the minimum wage isn't the same throughout the United States because states are free to have different minimum wage. Minimum wage in some states recognizes all income. California, oddly enough, if you were making $40 an hour, including tips, they don't count the tips. They only count the amount that's in the base salary. And that often means that somebody who would otherwise be able to not just work 40 hours, but work overtime and make a lot of money is denied that because of the nature of our law. But that's a California issue. My position on minimum wage, quite frankly, is recognizing that in a good economy that we had up until, let's say, March 3rd, we were paying far greater than minimum wage, more than twice minimum wage as an average wage to individuals. And I think it's important that we get back to an economy that doesn't look at minimum wage as anything other than a starting wage for maybe a brand new trainee. And I support that.
Thank you. Mr. Campanajar?
Yeah, so I think having a standard minimum wage across the country doesn't account for the fact that cost of living is different state to state, even within our county, it varies. So we have to make sure people have a wage they could live on. But honestly, the minimum wage, and I'll be frank, is abandoned on cancer now, because the jobs that are minimum wage now are going to be replaced not by immigration, but automation. And there are companies up north that are developing these robots that basically can make a hamburger in 27 seconds, which means they're going to save labor costs, have better produce, and you're going to shop there. So we have to make accommodations for that and make sure that we fill the skills gap. There are 7 million job vacancies and 6 million people looking for work. Before COVID, there were more jobs and people looking for work. We had a skills gap. So we need to invest in two industries, one in renewable energy, and move our industries that direction, because the most sought after job right now that's vacant is actually solar panel technician. And we need to make sure we have the skills for that, and also develop a 21st century caregiving economy to make sure that we're allocating actual good wages to people who care for the least of us, the young and the old and people with disabilities.
Thank you very much. Another question on the federal government, and we'll start with you, Mr. Campanajar. Should the federal government ensure that the U.S. Postal Service is funded and efficient?
Absolutely. Again, for caring for the least of these, we have the people who collect get their Medicare, get their Social Security checks. They need that support. Veterans who are really deeply affected, who get their support from the Postal Service. And right now in the middle of an election, we got to make sure that we're funding them. And we have to make sure that it's running efficiently as well. There are always improvements that we can make, but I'm the candidate that really supports our Postal Service. They have approval ratings among 80% of Americans, and it's for a reason. When it's their connection to the government that is meant to support them. It's their way, in many cases, that people get back their hard-earned taxpayer dollars given back to them after a lifetime of work through the Postal Service. So it's really important that we don't undercut them and malign them like some have, and that we don't, at this moment where we have a very important election, undercut their ability to get people mail-in ballots in the state and throughout the country.
Thank you. Mr. Issa?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to give a contrarian view here. The post office has been losing over $8 billion a year for a decade. They've continued to lose that, not paid into their own health retirement benefits, and then hidden it under the idea that no one else prepays. The post office was set up to be able to charge what it needed to charge to break even, including its operating reinvestments, but it hasn't done that. During my tenure as chairman, working on a bipartisan, bicameral basis, we tried to put together some real reforms. And to be honest, even with a guarantee of no layoffs, no firing, no forced retirements, we still were not able to get some of those unions, not the members, to agree to common sense reforms like cluster boxes. Almost everyone in the 50th Congressional District gets a cluster box. Well, the $8 billion plus dollars is lost because of delivery to chutes in a door in just a few million homes in America. But those are some of the changes that have to occur if we're going to be efficient.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa, the next question will start with you, and we are going to climate change questions. How do you think the federal government can help address the increasing problem of wildfires?
Well, during my tenure, I worked on a number of them that are pretty straightforward, making sure that we got new modern aircraft, the C-130Js, and they were equipped to do their job, providing not only drones, but the technology behind them, which General Atomics, which is in many of their employees, live in the 50th Congressional District, produces some great products that are helping us fight fires better, smarter, day and night. When it's all said and done, though, California and the federal government have to work to mitigate as much of that material that ultimately makes wildfires uncontrollable. You cannot allow debris, dead trees, and so on to build up for years in the name of ecology and then not expect these wildfires to be uncontrollable. So it's a combination of all of it. I've worked on those issues and I know they can be solved.
Thank you. Mr. Campanager?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I've talked to Diane Jacob, and she says we should try to prepare for the inevitable and prevent the worst when it comes to fires, but it's going to be part of our life, unfortunately. So we have to have wildfire prevention mechanisms and relief, and I will stand against the president when he threatens to take away our firefighting funding, which he's done numerous times, maybe to punish a Democratic state, but there are Republicans who live in this Democratic state, many of whom are in my district and are my neighbors. And the fires don't know how to discriminate between a Democrat and Republican. So we need to make sure we have that funding secured without question. And, you know, hold people accountable who've been part of the fires that we've had in recent years, SDG&E being one of them. They made a promise to replace all the utility posts that are wood into steel, and they haven't done all that yet. So holding corporations accountable that are contributing to this, and then making sure that we can stem the tide of unnecessary fires, whether man-made or naturally caused, and making sure we have the fire relief for those who've lost their homes through no fault of their own because of a fire.
Thank you very much. One more question in climate change. More generally, what would you do to combat climate change, Mr. Campanager?
It's a great question. It's the mother of all of our problems, and it could be the mother of all of our solutions if we cease to use our ingenuity to combat climate change. Donald Trump's own military, the Pentagon, said the biggest threat that we face isn't ISIS, which is sincerely a big threat, or Iran, which is a huge threat, or geopolitical foes like China or Russia. They said it was climate change because of rising tides, sinking coastlines where the military operates. Half of top priority military outposts and military facilities in our country are not operation ready because of mudslides and hurricanes and fires and other related incidents. So let's deny that this is, not deny this is happening, it is happening. The way we turn this into a positive is invest in renewable energy and bring along defense contracts to be the contractors to be the engines of that ingenuity. They have been before, they can again, and make sure that we are training people for these jobs of tomorrow and not cede the future of our energy to China, because they're not debating this. They're already doing it. We need to invest and scale up our renewable energy technology.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eisen.
As a nation, we're faced with a lot of challenges that aren't ours alone. They're a global challenge. And the changing climate, along with the basic problem of sustainable ecology, is a global problem. One of the things that I'm proud that I've worked with Republicans and Democrats in Congress, is to try to both here and around the world enter into agreements that help us become more sustainable, all the way from the South Pole, where we do scientific research, to the ocean and fisheries. I always try to make sure people understand, though, so many people want to talk about a single issue, climate change, rather than 7.5+ billion people that are eating more fish than the ocean produces, not having sustainability on land and the like. So I'm a big believer we have to deal with it all. We have to deal with the sustainable ecology, and renewable resources for electrification is certainly a part of it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa, we'll start the next question with you. We're going to move over to public health and insurance questions. How can Congress promote more inclusive access to health care?
You know, the federal government is the largest provider of health care. They've also been a major creator of the problem. The way Medicare and Medicaid, federally partially backed, have set prices, sometimes prices that are arbitrarily low, with the expectation that what isn't spent by our seniors will be picked up by the younger, healthier individuals. Obamacare itself had a tendency to shift between ages. I'm a big believer and will continue to work to try to drive down the cost of healthcare. That means tort reform that both lowers the cost of operations, but also reduces the amount of defensive medicine, fair pricing and transparent pricing that will cause people to know what they're really paying and be able to shop better. And candidly, we've got to shorten the time it takes to get drugs approved, because that drives the cost up also.
Thank you very much. Mr. Campanajar, just before you start, could you lean closer to your speaker? There are still apparently some people having more trouble hearing you. Thank you.
Well, that means they won't be upset if it's something they wouldn't like. but look, healthcare is very important, because all of us, almost all of us, came into this world through the healthcare system, a hospital, and most of us will leave this world through a healthcare system, the hospital. And how much time you have between those two moments in your life almost entirely relies on the kind of healthcare you have during your lifetime. And what can Congress do to fix this? First, by not being hypocrites. Every single member of Congress, 78% of their healthcare is paid for by subsidies from taxpayers. Talk about socialized medicine, right? 78%, are you kidding me, of your premium is paid for by me? Well, we're trying to figure out how to pay for our own healthcare. We need to make sure that whatever laws Congress passes on healthcare, that Congress members have the same healthcare that they are trying to impose on the rest of us. What I would do is increase competition, create a Kaiser-type plan nationally, create the option to buy into Medicare earlier by paying earlier. And if you do that, I think you'll have competition that will drive down costs, increase the quality of care, and will make the best provider win within the nonprofit, public, and private option, and also actualize the president's executive order by making sure that we could expand our markets to Canada and other countries for prescription drugs.
Thank you very much. There are a lot of questions on COVID, obviously. Mr. Campanajar, you'll be first with this one. Would you support continued federal spending for those who are unemployed due to the coronavirus?
I do. I think the best way to actually go about it, though, is through the Paycheck Protection Program, through small businesses, because for every dollar you spend for the small business grants for PPP loans that have to go to their employees. That's $1 saved with unemployment. So if we focus on the businesses that are going under and forcing people into unemployment and actually focus on the investment there, you'll be able to save two things at one time, a worker and their business that they were working for. So I would really shore up investing in small businesses in earnest and not give it to Ruth Chris or Jamba Juice, but actually focus on the small businesses. And that's what we should be doing. I think there's a lot of folks who, through no fault of their own, don't have work right now. And we should be able to give them some modest unemployment that allows them to get back on their feet, but incentivizes them to get back on their feet. I think there are some people who think that people just want to live off of the government dollar. I think a lot of people in this country want to work with dignity, and they favor dignity more than welfare. They want work, not welfare.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eisen.
Well, I think it's been pretty well reported that in some cases, people have been paid more not to go to work than to return to work. And I've always believed that people make rational decisions. And as much as someone might want to go back to work, if it means they're taking a cut, that's pretty tough. So I think there's no question at all, targeting any additional federal relief in concert with the states to help people get paid for work and get paid fully should be encouraged. But let's remember, getting back to work is also about this Manhattan Project, that the president launched, which is to get vaccines, to get improved treatment. And as we do that, it becomes more and more reasonable for people to come back to work, especially younger people, while protecting the elderly.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eisen, we'll start the next question with you. We're going to move over to immigration. What is your basic approach to immigration reform, and how would you address refugees and asylum seekers in our community?
Well, immigration is something I've served on the committee, authored legislation. As a matter of fact, one bill that passed unanimously out of the judiciary my last year there was Scott Peters and I co-sponsored H-1B reform. Not always the sexiest part, but important to try to make sure that the high-skilled labor we need is in fact high-skilled when it comes in to take those slots. And I'm proud to say that that'll be one of them that, you know, I will be on a bipartisan basis reauthoring if I'm fortunate enough to be returned. But you mentioned asylum seekers, and I think that's worth the other 30 seconds and more. I've visited the camps around the world in Lebanon. Juan Vargas and I went into the camps in Lebanon and Jordan and looked at the plight of these people, many of whom have applied for and would like to come here. And I support that kind of asylum of people who actually cannot return for the foreseeable future to where they come from. And I'm proud to say that that's something I've always supported.
Thank you. Mr. Campanager?
Yeah, look, me and my friend Isa, we both are the descendants of immigrants. Our parents immigrated here, and my father became a citizen thanks to the man behind him, Ronald Reagan. And when he used the term "Make America Great Again," he was referring to the prowess of our immigrants. We've always made America more American, so it's time that we have legislation that reflects that. And rather than run away from it, I would run to and complete that job in Congress. I'm talking about the bill that Congressman Issa actually authored in 2013 that would give some form of status for 11 million people in this country to have the certainty to live in this country, come out of the shadows, report bad actors if they exist, and be able to live, work, and retire with dignity like all of us. So I know that political winds have changed, but I think Congressman Issa had a lot of wisdom back then, and I promise as the next generation to finish the work that he left behind and do the good things that he wanted to do, and also make sure that we have comprehensive immigration reform with border security and also a pathway to citizenship.
Thank you very much. Mr. Campanager, we'll start the next question with you. We've moved over to voting. What are your thoughts on voting rights, and what policies would you promote to ensure a safe and fair election?
That's a great question. And one of the things I regret is that if I am in Congress, I will not get to serve a day with John Lewis. I envy you, Issa, for being able to do that. He was someone who really helped me realize that in this country, you have to try to understand more than you want to be understood and bring people together and approach things through nonviolence to bring people together. We know that in places like Georgia and other states, to a lesser degree, California, they have some really draconian voting rights laws. And what we need to do is take up the bill that was renamed in John Lewis's honor, the Voting Rights Act, and reinstitute it and make sure that people who want to vote are able to vote regardless of their socioeconomic or ethnic background. Right now, I think that, you know, there's a lot of punitive measures going out there that make it hard for people of certain communities to be able to vote. And that is precisely done in a way cynically to prevent certain people from voting to produce certain outcomes that would not benefit those who are in power now.
Thank you very much. One more on voting. We'll start with you, Mr. Campanajar. After the Citizens United decision, what is your position on accepting campaign donations from corporations?
Is this to me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I've rejected all corporate PAC money entirely. I don't think corporations are people. They don't breathe and they don't get COVID. I think that people should be able to have the voice. And what I want to do in Congress is introduce an amendment that would overturn Citizens United and give back the power of Congress, not to the lobbyists and the special interest in Washington, but to all of us, the people. And the way I see Congress is, you're my employer, people in my district, not the special interest. And I think what happens now with the special interest money in Congress is people go to Congress, they have good intentions, but then they start getting chewed up and spat out and they give their votes to the highest bidder. You know, we just lost Congressman Duncan Hunter. People think he was a bad apple. If he wasn't a bad apple, the barrel is rotten. Anybody you put in that system right now rots with it. So we have to change government. And part of that's making sure that we get money out of politics, because it's been a very corrosive part of our democracy. And if we do that one thing, getting money out of politics, all these high-minded reforms we're talking about today are actually doable.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa, I'm sorry. I realize I skipped you on that. So I'm going to give you 2 minutes to answer both what are your thoughts on voting rights and policies for a safe and fair election and donations from corporations.
Excellent. And I'm happy to combine them. I don't believe it should cost an individual a penny to register to vote, to receive his ballot and other information, and to deliver his vote by whatever means. And so I support that. And by the way, I don't believe it should cost anything to have an ID that helps verify that somebody has a right to vote. Some states do not agree. California doesn't have ID required, but some states do. And I believe it should not be a barrier anywhere. Citizens United, though, is a very different decision. Citizens United has nothing to do with corporate PAC money, as was earlier said. It, in fact, PAC money from individuals who work for companies, or PAC money from another type of corporation, unions, is still given from the individual. So it's still individual money, and people can choose to take or not take that category of money. The vast majority of the contributions I receive are in small amounts, $50 or less. And I think the same is true of my opponent. But corporate money, in other words, a company's ability to have free speech, to spend $1 million saying that an initiative on, you know, a new road that might help them, or on a new aircraft that might be built. You know, I can't but tell you that their free speech, whether it's about a candidate or it's about a project or it's about something, should never be stifled. I think America needs more free speech. I think there needs to be good disclosure. And I've been a big advocate that hidden money, when you see an ad and they deceive you as to who is actually, they make an organization name just for that one initiative, is wrong. You know, but, you know, the League of Women Voters has been around for a long time. They tell you what their position is on something, and as a result, they're accountable, and corporations should be too.
Thank you very much. All right, we're starting to bump up against our adjournment time, so I'm going to ask one last question.
Can't we revise and extend? Just go another hour?
You're doing such a great job, yeah. Mr. Issa, we'll start this one with you. How do you plan to stay connected and engaged with the community?
Well, I have almost 4 million miles with United Airlines, and almost all of those came from going back and forth every weekend. I've made more than 40 trips a year back to the district, in addition to trips overseas to do my job, to see what was going on in foreign affairs around the world. And so that's the first rule. The second one is, most people who know me know that my campaign stops have a tendency to be Costco and Home Depot, and just being out in the community. And so whether it's always being available in the district for impromptu meetings or making sure I'm available to all the groups on a regular basis, in person whenever we can. I have to be candid. Zoom is going to be a big asset because chambers often pick the exact time to have a meeting when you're in Washington, and I look forward to doing that when appropriate.
Thank you. Mr. Campanajar?
Yeah, I will have at least one town hall every single month in person, hopefully. If not in person, we'll do it virtually. And I have to say that I don't think it's accurate to say that the both of us share that mentality. I mean, one thing that I knew when I learned about my opponent was he was hiding from a rooftop from one of his town halls. So I think that's really important to distinguish who actually will in earnest say it. And our records don't bear that out. I've always been everywhere. I've been campaigning for 4 years, going to everybody. I even went to an event in Ramona yesterday with a bunch of Republicans, and I was there for them. And I won't duck from any kind of event, no matter how difficult it is. And I get called everything. I've gotten called a terrorist and everything else, but I still show up because even if they don't vote for me, I'll be voting for them in Congress if I'm so honored to serve. And our responsibility is to let voters make us uncomfortable. That's the job, is I have to be made uncomfortable by voters to push me to be a better representative of them. And I will never shrug that responsibility. I haven't for 4 years, and I certainly won't will in Congress.
Thank you very much. Before we go to closing remarks, I would just like to thank everyone for attending and asking such great questions. I got to put in a plug here for the League's Voters Edge website, which is a great online resource. It has information not only about the candidates, but the ballot issues and detailed voting information. All candidates for local offices have been invited to include their information, and I hope our two candidates today have done that. Also, be sure to register to vote, and if you want to check to make sure you are and that your address is correct, sdvote.com. And for goodness sakes, be sure to fill out the census. This is how money comes to your community to help everyone. My2020census.gov if you need to go there. Also, I'd like to encourage the audience to attend more League candidate forums, such as the one tomorrow for the San Diego Unified School Board. All of our forums and events are listed on our League website calendar. And if you have to go anywhere else for those links, they should all be in the chat box. And now for the closing statements, each candidate will have 2 minutes and we're going in reverse order. So Mr. Campanajar, your closing statement.
Well, thank you so much. This time did go really fast, and I agree with Daryl. I would be here longer if we could. But I want you to know that my commitment to this district is not a fleeting passion. You're not my plan B. You are not my second option. You have always been my commitment for these almost 4 years now. And this election to me is not about the left versus the right. It's about the outsiders like all of us in the 50th, the forgotten people, the afterthought of San Diego County, and the insiders in Washington, people who have been there very long. And for them, all pathways lead to D.C. For me, I will always run in the 50th. I will never choose another district because this is my community. And I don't believe that politicians should pick their voters. I think voters should pick their politicians. So I hope this election that you'll choose an East County son, someone who has really devoted themselves to this district for the past 4 years now. And I promise you to always do that, to be honest and upfront, to try to work with everybody. I've managed to piss off Democrats and Republicans in this race, and I think that means I'm doing a good job because I'm not here to kowtow to any party. I know party leaders tell me where to sit, but I know where I stand, and I stand with the people of the 50th Congressional District, all 800,000 of you, and I will never take money from special interests, and I'll never sell out my votes to the highest bidder in Washington. I will always focus on the common person, again, trying to live, work, and retire with dignity, just like my mother tried to, and just like I've tried to throughout my life. My biggest selling point, I think, is that I am from here and I'm of here. And my biggest hope is I could lean on my Republican colleagues on the other side of the aisle to deliver for this district, including Mr. Issa, if I'm so honored to serve. I hope we'll be able to dust off our bruises and work together in the future. And I mean that in earnest. So hopefully we could come together. We have issues that are bigger than all of us. And the only way we do it is through addition, not subtraction, not exploding division, but exploring unity. And I really do hope that the creed of my campaign, Together We Can, is actualized after November 3rd for our district. We haven't had a congressman in a year, and it's time that we have someone to make up for lost time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Issa.
Thank you. You know, I'm not born here. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. But since 1985, I've been deeply invested in this community. When I first moved my factory to San Marcos in the 50th, number was different then, but 50th Congressional District, and began adding employees as we grew throughout the region of Escondido and North County and into Riverside, I grew to know my community. So since 1985, I've been deeply invested, been a member of both regional chambers in North County and the Greater San Diego Chamber. It's the reason that the Greater San Diego Chamber has endorsed me. Kevin Faulkner has endorsed me. Diane Jacobs has endorsed me. Mayor Bill Wells has endorsed me. Mayor Mike Nagar up in Temecula has endorsed me. Former Mayor Sam Abed has endorsed me. Those aren't just endorsements by people who think I came into the community. They're people that know that for 12 years I represented a substantial portion of this district. And then when it was cut up through to gerrymandering, I happened to pick to stay in another portion of it, the portion that had Camp Pendleton in it, and Duncan Hunter took this portion. I could have just as easily served in the 50th, but that's not the point. The point is I'm deeply committed to this district and this community. Two-thirds of this district is not in East County. The fact is the majority of this district is North County and into Riverside County. And these are areas that I have driven through, plowed, and been very involved in. And candidly, South and East County are not areas that are alien to me. So I'm deeply committed to it. I've been committed to it. I have a track record. And when I return with 18 years of seniority, on day one, I'll know how to do the job, something I've done. In fairness, I'm running on my record, and I believe my record speaks for itself.
Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank everybody for attending this forum. It looks like we had well over 130 audience members for this, so I thank everyone who tuned in. I want to thank CASA for hosting this, and the League of Women Voters, obviously. I want to thank the candidates for running for office. Running for office is not an easy task. It is not an inexpensive task. It is a time-consuming task. I think everybody is aware of that, and so I thank you both for running, and I thank you both for attending this forum. And I know that everybody tuned in tonight because they follow the League's motto, which is don't just be a voter, be an informed voter. So with that, we'll sign off. Thank you all again.
Thank you.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producers, Miriam Raftery and John Sepulveda. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.